one little sentence in passing. He said, and therefore you could say the purpose of your life is to make memories to hook things onto, because otherwise you'll be at the end of your life and you won't remember any of it.
This is the Soul Hustle Podcast with Peter Alwood, episode number 048. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Slow Hustle Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Alwood, and if you're new to the show and you're looking for conversations that evoke raw emotion and honesty, showcasing the ups and downs of the entrepreneurial lifestyle, you've found it. We are here for the people who wonder how founders and entrepreneurs navigate the struggles of building a business while also being present and managing their family life. Previous episodes include Rand Fishkin, Pamela Slim, Tucker Max, and plenty more. You and I are about to be joined by Derek Sivers. You guys, this guy is amazing. I've been following for years at Sivers.org and was super excited to have him on the show. We're going to talk about so many things. His background, CD Baby, founding that, and exiting in 2008 for $22 million and then giving all the money away. So we could talk about that. We talk about his writings on Sivers.org and some of the inspiration that's there. His book, Anything That You Want, and that manifesto that he wrote, which sounds super interesting. I'm super excited to read that. And he has just amazing insight on long-term thinking, thinking more deeply, slow thinking, like he talks about, to just kind of have more of an awareness about what it is and how you want to respond to certain situations, sitting and thinking with his diary and pondering big business decisions, big life decisions. And so you guys will not be disappointed in the conversation that we had. Listen closely, bring your notebook and pen. You guys are going to love it. Without any further ado, I bring to you Derek Sivers. Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Slow Hustle Podcast. Today, I get to chat with Derek Sivers. I don't even know where to start with his intro. He founded CD Baby, an online CD store, in 1997, sold it for $22 million, and then gave it away. He's an author whose most recent book is titled Anything You Want. He's also a frequent speaker at TED with over 5 million views. He writes insightful and deep blog posts on Sivers.org, which is something that I've been like subscribed to and loving for years. If you're not a subscriber, do it. Derek, thanks very much for being here, man.
Thanks, Peter. Nice intro.
Yeah, thanks, dude. So I am like beyond excited to chat with you. You know, the reasons that, you know, you're such an inspiration to me. I think I first stumbled upon you. You did some like free Q&A on AppSumo or something like that. Years ago.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking like, dude, this guy's deep and he's got some really good information and insight. And so I think that was like where like my first kind of intro into your work and what you were doing and learning about that. So for folks that are not as plugged in, do you mind sharing a little bit of your entrepreneurial journey, what led up to CD Baby, and then kind of what led up to your current endeavors?
Yeah. In fact, I think, let me just double check. The thing that you're talking about, I think I posted it on my site too. Yeah. If you go to sivers.org/uncommon, I named that talk Uncommon Sense, the one that you saw first on AppSumo.
Okay.
So yeah, sivers.org/uncommon. You'll cool. See the thing that you saw. So you're just asking like a little bit about my background. Really, I was just a musician. And this is important to know that ever since I was 14 years old, all I wanted was to be a successful musician. And it's really all I did from the age of 14 on, was just focused 100% on music and being a full-time musician, a professional musician. In fact, last time I had a day job was 1992. I quit my last job and I was a full-time musician ever since. So being a musician is a little bit like being an entrepreneur, or let's say knowing that I wanted to be a musician in advance is a different mindset. So every now and then, somebody will ask me this question, like, how did you get the courage to quit your day job or quit your job and start a company? I say, no, hold on. I have to disagree with the question, because ever since I was 14, I knew like I would never have a paycheck. I would never have insurance. I would never have a pension. I would have no job security. Like, if you decide to be a musician, it's deciding that every dollar you earn is going to be because you hustled your ass off and got a gig and got another gig and, you know, et cetera. So it's a life of hustling. And so I think it was a natural progression then to become an entrepreneur because I already was in a way, you know what I mean? So when I started CD Baby, it was after 15 years of me focusing 100% on me and my music, I just created this little online store to sell my CD. It was really just on my band's website. But then some of my musician friends in New York said, hey man, could you sell my CD through that thing? And I said, sure. It was like a favor that I was doing to give back to my fellow musicians. But then it just took off. And became the largest seller of independent music on the web with almost 200,000 musician clients and 100 million in sales. And I had 85 employees and way too much responsibility. So after 10 years, I just was feeling pretty done with it. And that's when I sold. So.
Gotcha. And so you would say that at the age of 14, you knew you were going to be an entrepreneur?
I knew I was going to be a musician. It wasn't till 30 years later, I don't know, 20 years later when people... Even with CD Baby, I wasn't in an entrepreneur world. Like, I don't get this whole world of tech incubators and startups. Like, I'm not in that world. It was only after I sold CD Baby that people asked me to come into that world because I'd sold my company. So now they valued my opinion. But the whole time I was doing CD Baby, I was in music, surrounded 100% by musicians. And in fact, everybody that worked at my company was a musician. Like, it was all music. It was by musicians for musicians. I didn't even, you know, I guess entrepreneur was a label that other people used for me. I didn't think of it like that. But yeah, now after the fact, people call me that. And I say, yeah, I guess, you know, by that definition, I've been an entrepreneur since I was 14 and decided to make a living making music.
So two questions for you. One, how do you think that it framed your mindset? You said you knew from the age of 14 you were going to be a musician. So do you think that allowed you to like let go of the idea of having to get a job or follow the common path? You're like, oh, well, I'm not doing that. And so
yeah.
That allowed you to like let go of all of like those expectations.
Well, it was never there in the first place. Yeah. I didn't have them before 14. I guess, yeah, I never thought I would get a job somewhere. So it's a different thing. When I would see even in high school, people preparing for college so they could go to college to get a good job someday. And I just felt like, no, none of this applies to me. Like, I never want a job. Mm-hmm. It's a different mindset. You know, I find it hard to understand this mindset of entitlement, of this feeling that the world owes me a living, you know, or the idea of unions and all that. That's just never been my world because, yeah, when you're doing something like music, people don't pay you to play music unless you're going to provide them that much cash value for entertainment that night, or, you know, that much value for your guitar solo on their record or whatever it may be. People only open up their wallets to pay you if it has immediate value to them. And that's the only way I ever expected that I would make money, is immediately providing something for value. So even this idea of like getting investors for your business, like I don't even understand that. I think, well, if your business was valuable, you'd have customers paying you. So I've never had investors. I've never invested in anything. I just don't really understand that world. That doesn't fit into my worldview. I mean, I think what it means to be an entrepreneur is it's inventing something that doesn't exist, that people have proven that they need because they're happy to pay for it. I don't think you can call yourself an entrepreneur if you're doing something that people aren't paying for. Like starting a blog that people read isn't being an entrepreneur because people aren't paying for it. That's just, you know, you're just doing something for fun or popularity or whatever it may be. It has to be something that people are happy to pay for. That's when you know you're onto something. And if people aren't happy to pay for it, then you haven't found something that people need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm with you there. It's like, you know, there is a big push to go and get funded, right? And it's almost like they skip the step of finding out, does anybody want the shit you're creating? first, right? Like, let's find out that, and then maybe you can get some cash to like scale your business if you want to scale it really fast for some like economic reason, you know, timing or whatever, competition. But why don't you find out if anybody actually wants to buy your stuff?
Right. Yeah. So I know when we're going to get to the slowness portion of this interview, I'm going to have more to say about that then.
Okay. All right. We'll remember to bring it back full circle. And so, like, what do you think made CD Baby a standout company? I mean, to me, just like hearing you talk about it, it's like, well, you're by musicians for musicians. And so you had that angle versus someone that was there to like just make a quick buck. So it's just completely different culture, I'm assuming. But I mean, do you think that the story of the shrink wrapped squid, and if you guys aren't, you know, are not familiar, go ahead and Google it. CD Baby shrink wrapped squid, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Like, do you think that sums it up? Do you want to tell that story a little bit?
Sure. Actually, I made a short URL for that. If you go to sivers.org/squid, it will redirect you to the YouTube video where the guy tells his story about how it was just one quirky little story, right? That at every step of the business, I tried to think what would be the dream come true for the customer's point of view. And so usually that was done from the musician point of view. Like, what would be a musician's dream come true distribution deal? Like, first you think of it from that point of view, and then I'd think, can I provide that? And so from the customer's point of view, people who went to cdbaby.com to buy music, I would think, from their point of view, what would be ideal? And I thought, I should have a text box at the end of the order where they can make any special request, anything. You know, it might be, could you please Christmas wrap this? It might be something else, like, please wait a week before sending it because I won't be home yet. You know, like, I just wanted to leave a place where they could communicate with a real person. And so I did say, you know, please, any special requests? Yes, anything. And so one day somebody said, I'm in the mood for some cinnamon gum. And one of the guys in the warehouse got this order, and there at the bottom of the invoice, it says, I'm in the mood for some cinnamon gum. And he said, I was about to go out to the gas station anyway. Hold on, put this order aside. He put the order aside. He went out to the gas station, picked up some cinnamon gum, dropped it in the box, and sent it to the guy. And, you know, the customer that got the cinnamon gum went, whoa, oh my God. And he went onto his blog and his Twitter and his Facebook, whatever. He talked all about this amazing order he got from CD Baby. And what a cool company. I just happened to mention I wanted cinnamon gum. They included it. What a cool company. And God, I don't know how many hundreds of people came to us because of that one thing, right? And then the squid story is kind of similar, where a guy bought a CD where the album cover was like a guy with a squid on his head. And so at the end of his order, he said, special requests, yes, I would like a rubber squid included with my order. If you do not have a rubber squid, then a real squid will do. And it just so happens that some musician from Korea that had sent us a box of CDs recently included a shrink-wrapped, real squid in with his CDs, saying, you know, a present for CD Baby. I love you guys. Here, enjoy some squid. And the guys in the warehouse had kept this like tacked up on the wall for a while. And so when, oh my God, an order comes in saying a real squid would do, the guys in the warehouse took it off the shelf, dropped it in the box, and sent the guy some squid. I didn't find out about this until a month later, because the customer who received the squid in his order went, oh my God. And he went onto YouTube and told the story about how he received the squid in his order. And you could see how many thousands of views that video has and how many people heard of CD Baby because of that story. So I think about this when people talk about, like, how can I call attention to my business? How can I make a name for myself in the marketplace? But it's just these tiny little things you do that are out of the ordinary. So I think Seth Godin wrote the book 10 years ago called Purple Cow.
Yeah, that's a great book.
If you haven't read it, don't let the fact that it's 10 years old make you think that it's moot. It's very appropriate right now. Read Purple Cow, because it's all about finding these little things you can do to stand out.
Yeah. It's a great book and a classic. I agree. 10 years old or not, doesn't really matter. Do you think that the squid and the gum. I mean, it's obviously different, right? Like people will put these requests in, they're not expecting to get anything. It's even different just to have that request box to begin with. But do you think a big part of it, Derek, is that like it's personalizing the service? It's like, oh, they're this is not like a machine operated business. There's a person at the other end. They're human beings. Yeah. They have personalities. They have, you know, their own sense of humor. And that is what like creates these customers for life, so to speak. Like,
oh, do you think absolutely. That's what it is? Especially online, so many internet businesses are so focused on automating and optimizing everything that they remove the human touch intentionally, right? Mm-hmm. So I think whenever you can show a real person, like, God, you just win loyalty. And I didn't think of this until you just asked, but just a few months ago, I was going to Belgium and I was going to spend a month and a half there. And I wanted to sign up for a cell phone company, like get a real SIM card and just an ongoing thing. So I wouldn't have to get a temporary SIM card each time. I just decided, no, I want to subscribe to some company and just get a monthly plan because I go there enough. So I was looking into this company that somebody had recommended called Mobile Vikings. And they're already kind of like a smaller reseller for one of the big three cell phone providers in Belgium. But what I asked the guy is, I emailed customer service and I said, I'd like to get, I said, can you let me choose my number? I'd like to get a number that I can remember instead of having to look it up every time. Because for some reason, phone numbers in Belgium are really long. And I was like, it would really help if I could look at a selection of numbers and pick one that I think I'd be able to memorize better. And so a real person emailed back and said, I'm so sorry, we don't have that ability. But he said, I'll give you a little hint. He said, when we mail you your SIM card, it has the phone number. We email you the phone number attached to that SIM card at the moment the SIM card is shipped. He said, you didn't hear it from me, but if you find that number difficult to remember, just say that the SIM card never arrived in the mail and we'll send you another one. He said, we can do this up to 5 times before it's considered a fraudulent order. So he said, yeah, you didn't hear it from me, but you have up to 5 times to do this. And I was like, that is the coolest tip. And I love that it's like he was kind of like saying it with a wink, like not supposed to. So now I feel like committed to Mobile Vikings for life, you know, like that's my company. Because some person emailed me back with a real human response.
A human response. I was just talking to somebody about this yesterday. It's like you call the company and they give you their canned spiel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you tell them about how that response is not acceptable, right? In a kind way, I want to say. And then they give you the same response again. And you're like, dude, come on. Like, you're a human being. If you're in my shoes, what would you want? Like, you'd want show me some sympathy at least, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, that's what that guy did for you or gal did for you. It's like, oh, well, we don't do that. But if I were you, this is what I would do because I understand not being able to remember the number. So, I think it's a great example. And, you know,
sorry on that point before we change subjects. Yeah. Seth Godin made a good point years ago that you should put your best people on customer service. Like, that's not something to send out to the Philippines and keep your costs as low as possible. Because in that moment, when somebody contacts your company, like, this is your moment to shine. Like, first, you should want people to contact your company, right? Like, you should encourage it. Like, please contact us because this is the moment where you might win years of loyalty in a 1 minute conversation, right? Mm-hmm. So, not only encourage people to contact you. And then when they do, you need to have your best people there that have authority and leeway to do things and people that are people, you know, whatever you call them, people person, charming, friendly, helpful. Those are the people you need to have on customer facing jobs. Because how long did it take that guy from Mobile Vikings to write that email, right? Like 20 seconds, 30 seconds. But now I'm going to spend hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars with this company over the years because of that one 20-second interaction. And there's so much to learn from that. Like, encourage people to contact you and shine when they do.
Shine when you do. And the human element is so critically important. And to have like that person's interest first is an example I've shared before where, you know, a previous company, I'd answer the phone and the customer would be looking for a product and I'd ask them kind of some more qualifying questions about why they wanted it. And then sometimes I would say, you know what? This is not a good fit for you.
people love that when you tell them.
I think you should buy XYZ competitor's product because this one really, I mean, I'd like to sell it to you, but it's just for what you want to use it for, it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
And you would catch people off guard. They'd even say, well, no, they'd argue with you about why they should buy it.
Yep.
And so that to me was like kind of a win. And I think that as long as you add that human element, not only do you win that customer's, you know, business and loyalty, but they're also going to tell their friends, just like the gum example, just like the squid example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Derek, I'd love to chat with you about, you know, your recent book. I think it came out about a month ago called Anything You Want. It's a very bold statement, and I can't wait to read it. And so just the reviews alone say so much about it. Do you want to share a little bit about that book and kind of what it's about?
Yeah. Well, you could read it in the time that we've spent talking already. It's a very tiny little book. Again, Seth Godin asked me to write a book. And at first I said, no, I don't feel like telling my tale. And he said, well, could you extract the lessons that you learned in building, growing, and then selling CD Baby? And I said, ah, now that I can do. So it's a tiny little book. He started a little publishing company where he had the idea for making these short little, he called them manifestos. So it's like 88 pages. You can read it in under an hour. And it's just as succinct as can be, 40 succinct lessons that I learned. I think like the most important things I learned in starting, growing, and selling my company. And that's it.
Very cool. Very cool. And I like the idea of a manifesto. And it kind of speaks to something I had later on in the episode that I wanted to talk about, which is your kind of summary of books that you've read. I think you said you had over 200 that's on the site. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea that, you know, there are a lot of books that are 200, 300 pages that don't need to be. And I understand why they need to be that they want them to be that long, but they don't need to be. So I love the idea of a manifesto like you're talking about, or like this Cliff Notes version, so to speak. Do you want to talk about that project a little bit, about that that summary of books that you read?
Yeah, sure. So I love books. I mean, everybody has their own method of input that they prefer. A lot of people like podcasts. Other people like video podcasts. Other people like to, you know, watch documentaries on TV. People like audiobooks. Some people like paper books. So for me, it's books. Books are my favorite way that I learn things. And the main reason why is because whenever I'm reading something, every sentence that makes me go, oh, wow, that's powerful, I'll like underline that sentence, or every paragraph that I find really counterintuitive that I want to remember this, I'll circle that paragraph. And then when I'm done with the book, I would type all of those underlined sentences and paragraphs, I'd type them into a text file, sometimes change the wording a bit to something that was more comfortable for me to remember. The point was that I wanted to remember everything I had learned. And I started doing this in 2007 because that's when I realized that there were some amazing books I read before 2007. And in the moment you read a book, you get so inspired, or even, you know, like same thing with listening to a podcast like this or watching something, is that you can get really inspired in the moment, but then talk to you two years later and everything you learned from that time was gone because you didn't really internalize it, right? Like it might be in there somewhere, but I wanted to remember it more. So that's why I take these detailed notes. And I would review these notes all the time. Like I put them onto my phone, and anytime I was just had some spare time sitting on the bus or whatever, I would like pull up my phone and like reread some of the notes from a book that applied, and I just wanted to memorize it. So that's the main reason I started taking notes. And I started doing that 8 years ago. And so I've read 220 something books in the last 8 years, and I started putting all of my notes online. Hmm. So originally this was just something I was doing just for me. But after a few years, I realized it would be quite easy for me to share it on my website. I just built a little script where I can copy my text files, and it creates a little web page for that book and adds it to the list of books. So if you go to my website at sivers.org/book, you'll see the big list of 220 books with actually I rate everyone with a 0 to 10 rating with my favorite ones at the top. So if you go to sivers.org/book, like my most highly recommended books that I think you should read are at top, and then scroll down and you'll see what hits you. It seems like a good fit. So with that as the context, I realized that every time I would get really excited about a book and I would tell my friends about it, most of my friends are not book readers. They're smart people, but just books aren't really their main thing, right? They'll read articles, they'll watch TV shows, but they just won't read books. And so I would tell them about this amazing book. I'd say, Jeff, oh my God, you have to read this book. It was so good. And he'd say, like, dude, I'm not going to read the book. Just tell me what to do. And I noticed that that was always my friend's question, is just tell me what to do. Like, what does it say I should do? He didn't even say, like, explain all of the concepts and ideas in it. It was like, no, what's the takeaway? Like, what am I actually going to use in my life? And I liked the fact that it distilled down to that, because like you said, so many books are longer than they need to be. It's like 350 pages of argument and anecdotal stories and proof and all that. And really, out of the 350-page book, you could compress the whole thing into a few sentences of like, so if this is true, then what should I do? You should do X, Y, Z. Okay, well, if you already trusted the source, that's all you really need to know. Like, my friend Jeff trusts me. And so when I'm raving about a book, he's saying, just tell me what to do. That's all he needs to know. And I could say, well, it says that you should, you know, such and such, say hell yeah or no, or whatever it may be. So the project that you're talking about is based on that. Like, I wonder now if I could go back through the last 220 books I read and extract just the tell me what to do bits out of it. And most books I've noticed don't speak this way. They don't tell you what to do. They tend to talk around subjects and they explore all the ideas, or they share research and share ideas or philosophies, but they don't tell you what to do. And so I made that my project that I'm working on right now, is how to take all of this wisdom and advice I've, or no, wisdom that I've learned over the last 8 years, and how to compress it into just some tell me what to do type sentences. So that's what I'm working on.
That's awesome. And I was just chatting with, I was telling you before we started recording, I was chatting with Hal Elrod today, author of Miracle Morning, and he has this whole deal where it's like six, you know, different exercises in the morning, but then there's four more and they're about habit forming. And so we talked just about this specific thing. It's like you read books, you're very inspired, you get this endorphin rush or whatever you want to call it. When you're reading it, you feel motivated, and then you put it down. And then it's like, what the hell is the point? You know, like, it's good to have this excitement, but then if it doesn't change your habit, or it doesn't change your trajectory, or it doesn't change something, an activity that you do every single day, yeah, it doesn't have the lasting effort. And so he was talking about, yeah, how you forget 75 to 90% of what you read pretty much instantaneously. And so I like the idea that you're, you know, creating this, you know, kind of tell me what to do bullet points, and that you're saying that you refer to them personally. Do you have like a, some type of framework where it's like, here's how I, if I have like this main takeaway from a book and I want to implement it in my life, do you have a mechanism in order to like bring that into your everyday?
No, I think the first thing is internalizing it, like a real awareness. Like, you have to kind of get this idea and think about it multiple times. So let me think of a specific one. Okay, I read a book once that made this point that you only learn when something goes against your expectations. If everything in life falls in line with your expectations, then you're not learning anything. You're like, yeah, that's just what I expected. So we're really only learning when something surprises our expectations. And he said that this, when something surprises your expectations, it puts your mind into more of like an open learning mode. Like, oh, wow, things aren't what I seemed. Or aren't what I thought. Therefore, what else is not as it seems? And it keeps you in that learning mindset. So he said, if you want to keep learning and growing, you should make a point of keeping yourself surprised as much as possible. Hmm. And he said, one way to do this is to constantly, say, read books about subjects you know nothing about, talk to people that you ordinarily wouldn't talk with, that you feel almost intimidated by, or aversion to, and getting to know those people, it may really surprise you. And he mentioned something about going to places that are very unlike the place where you grew up or where you live. And I read this book around the time that I was selling CD Baby, or maybe about a year before. And I felt like, yeah, you know, I'm very free in my life right now. I'm not tied down to anything. I don't have to be at the office. I'm free to go anywhere and I can afford to. So one way to keep my mind open and active is to live all around the world and keep moving and say, like, live in Brazil for 6 months until it feels comfortable, until it's no longer surprising me daily, and then maybe move to Beijing until it's no longer surprising me daily, and then move to Mumbai until it's no longer surprising me daily. You know, like, just a way of keeping yourself in learning mode. So you asked about a framework. So I think that's something that I read that sentence or paragraph in the book, circled it, later put it into my notes, later reviewed it a few more times. And then later, when I was, like, you know, spending some quiet time with a diary or just thinking about my life or thinking about that, like, I write a lot. So I just spent a little time writing about that. And that's where I came up with the idea that, yeah, living around the world is a good way to make that happen. So, yeah, I don't have a specific framework that I could say, yeah, Peter, here's my framework for making things happen or making changes stick. But it is more like just spending time thinking about and maybe writing about what you've learned.
I like that. And I think that revisiting those ideas over and over kind of speaks to what we talked about earlier, which is about slow thinking, you know, and just, like, really kind of sitting and letting that simmer until you have that idea that comes to you. And so what came to mind when you were talking about opening your mind to learning is, it reminds me of an article that I've referenced many, many, many times on the podcast, which is, this article was talking about how as you get older, time, your perception of time speeds up. And the whole thing was that your brain essentially has a cache. And when you're staying in the same environment, talking to the same people, driving on the same roads, doing the same things, your brain just doesn't have to process those things. They're not new to you anymore. Mm-hmm. And so in order to slow down your perception of time, you have to change your environment. You have to change your experiences. You have to do these things. All the things that you just mentioned. And so it actually speaks to me currently. It's very applicable, right? Because I'm like, you know, we're spending 10 months traveling the country with the family for those exact reasons. It's like, if I'm comfortable, I don't need to go out and meet anybody. Like, if I get into a room and there's 100 people there and I know 20, what are you going to do? You're going to gravitate to the 20 people. And the only way to make sure you stretch yourself and talk to folks that you normally wouldn't talk to is to put yourself in a room where you don't know a damn soul.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I love that you're bringing this up. This is one of my favorite subjects. That and you learn things in the weirdest places. So to me, there was this book called Moonwalking with Einstein that I saw a bunch of glowing reviews about. And so I read it. It was about memorization. It was like a journalist's tale of how he first was hired to write a little article about a memory expert and found it interesting. And within a year and a half, he was a memory expert himself. And then, so he's telling his tale of how he did this. And so it seems like, you know, if you're just talking about, like, I'm trying to build my business, how can I build my business, or I'm trying to be happy, or I'm trying to find my calling, you'd think, what does reading a journalist's tale about memorization have to do with my life? But you never know where you're going to pick up these tiny little tidbits that'll change your life, right? So it was just the tiniest little sentence deep in the middle of the book somewhere where the author was interviewing another memory expert, and he said, our memories don't stick on our mind unless they have something to hook onto, life events to hook onto. So if you remember very clearly that 2009 was the year you got fired, or 2012 was the year you graduated college, you're always going to remember that year as something to hook onto. But then, say, for example, if you just worked at some dumb job from 2013 to 2017 and life was just a routine, then you might not remember whether something happened in 2014 or 16 or whatever. Like, it'll just be a blur to you because you didn't have any events to hook onto in this time. So what he said is, if you want your memories to stick in life, you need events to hook onto. And then again, just one little sentence in passing, he said, and therefore you could say the purpose of your life is to make memories to hook things onto, because otherwise you'll be at the end of your life and you won't remember any of it. And kind of like, you know, a tree falls in a forest, no one hears it. Did it make a sound? It's kind of like, if you can't remember your life, did it happen? So yeah, if you want to remember your life, you need to make events to hook your memories onto. And it was just like one paragraph in a book, but that influenced me so much that my friends sometimes think I'm crazy for all of the radical changes I make in my life, but they don't understand that I'm making memories. Yeah, I make relatively big changes in my life often because it's fun, and it's a challenge, and it's daring, and it's exciting, but man, I remember everything because my life is never routine. I have lots to hook my memories onto, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's a couple that, from a year to think.com, they took their two children, traveled around the world for a year, documented it, did an amazing job. And I was talking with Mark there, and he's like, I can remember every single day.
Yeah.
He's like, I can remember every single thing we did every single day because they were all new, some painful, some exciting, some not, but they were all new and they were all over the world. He's like, I can remember every single day versus just a regular day going to work, coming home. There are lots of days that kind of just, you know, blend together.
You know, yeah. And this is actually the other reason I started writing a good old fashioned diary too, that at the end of each day, I put aside sometimes just 2 minutes and I just write down like what happened today. And it's not deep thoughts. Sometimes it's just, this is what happened today. And I only started doing this about a year and a half ago because I realized like that would have been useful. Like I kind of wish when I look back to say like other times in my life, like when I started CD Baby or when I went through like my first breakup or when I met the woman that later became my wife kind of thing, like, how was I feeling back then? What did my days involve back then? Like, I think I remember, but is my memory foggy? I would more likely trust myself writing at the end of that day instead of looking back 5 years later, trying to remember. So I'd say even if you're making a life full of memories, 20 years later, like you say you remember everything now, but yeah, 20 years later, you might not. So I still think it's worth putting aside even just a few minutes to document what you did today, just so you can look back and remember like, oh, wow, I used to spend a lot more time worrying or I used to spend a lot more time writing or whatever it may be. It might be useful for you to look back in 20 years.
Speaking of writing and your, you know, the blog, sivers.org, what would you say is your most well-received blog post?
Ah, so you sent me this question in advance and we'll talk about that later. So I actually went and looked up what blogs have the most comments. I asked my database, like, show me the top 5 blog posts sorted by the number of comments. Okay. And I use that as an indicator of people's interest in them. So the number one is my story about how I donated my company to charity, mm-hmm. Which you haven't really talked about. Number two is where I asked songwriters, like, what do you do to get feedback on a song you've written? Number three, I was surprised, 920 comments. Oh, I should mention that. Yeah. So that about giving my company to charity, almost 1500 comments on that one. Songwriters asking for feedback on their songs, 950 comments. So this one was a surprise. I wrote a post once just a couple of years ago saying you don't have to be local. And it was me finally admitting that I don't really enjoy being part of a local community, that I like to focus my attention worldwide, maybe because I've been so nomadic, but I like doing things that are not local based, but that are world based, where my physical location is kind of moot. I'm doing things for the world. And that got 920 comments from people saying like, oh my God, like, thank you for mentioning this. Like, I've always felt kind of not really a part of my community and I can relate to this. People don't talk about this enough. Number four is I posted a Kurt Vonnegut. I saw him speak before he died and he told a great story about, drama and the Cinderella story and the arcs. It's linked from the front page of my site. And number five also surprised me is that I posted this thing a few years ago about somebody emailed me to ask my advice about his company and like saying that he was going to try to find investors for his band or something like that. And I said, like, I don't think you're going to find any investors for your band. I think it's all up to you. Nobody's going to help you. You have to do this all yourself. And he got really angry and upset by that. And I said, wow, that surprised me because to me, when somebody says nobody's going to help you, it's all up to you, that to me is like an encouraging, powerful, like, yeah, it's all up to me. I can do this thing all by myself. Like that's encouraging. But to him, that was like the saddest thing he could ever hear. And he got really upset by it. So I posted this post just kind of asking people, the subject is nobody's going to help you. Does that encourage you or discourage you? And yeah, 720 comments on that. So yeah, thanks for asking. I'd always been curious to run that little query on my blog, and I'd never done it before you asked.
Well, I want to speak to a few of those. And one we plan to talk about, which is donating the proceeds to charity. Like, what the hell? I mean, I don't know how many people have probably asked that question. Like, you know, and so like, what was going through your mind? I've got a little bit of insight, but I'd love for you to share with the community here of like why you made that decision. And was it easy?
Okay. Well, first, the decision was when to sell your company. And I think anybody who's listening to this, that if you have a company now or someday you might, I wrote a little article about this at sivers.org/done, D-O-N-E, that is kind of like how I knew I was done with my company. And first, I think you have to get to that point where, like, I do get that question a lot, like, you know, I have the option to sell my company or I'm thinking of it or something, and how will I know? And so my answer is like, when it feels finished, like to me, it felt like I had put the final brush stroke on a mural I had been working on for 10 years, or I'd written the final sentence of my novel or something. It felt like I'm done. Like I have nothing more to add, because for 10 years, people had been asking me to sell my company. I mean, I started it during the first dot-com boom. And so for 10 years, I had people offering me millions of dollars. And I said, nope, nope, nope. The amount of money doesn't matter. I'm not done. I'm enjoying this. And then after 10 years, I got three more requests to sell my company, three requests in 1 week. And I told all of them, nope, nope, nope. But then that week, I spent some quiet time with my diary. And I was like, actually, I have no idea what's next. Like, I really am feeling done. Like, I have no vision left. I have no goals for the future, or more like my goals are more diminishing returns. It would be a lot of work to make an incremental tiny improvement at this point. So I was like, maybe I'm done. And I just kind of pictured myself not being Derek at cdbaby.com anymore. And for the first time in 10 years, that felt kind of nice. So that's how I knew I was done. So first, I think you got to get to that point wholeheartedly, because yeah, you don't want to feel conflicted about that. Then I asked, I knew somebody that had sold his company just a year or two before, and I called him. He was a friend of mine in a very similar situation. And I called him and I asked, like, how was it? Any regrets? And he said, yeah, my biggest regret is that I agreed to work for them. He said, I've been my own boss for 15 years. And suddenly, like, because they acquired my company, now he said, I have a boss. And he tells me no to things that I want to do with my website, which I'm in charge of, but I still have to answer to somebody else. He said, it feels really icky. I don't like it. I was like, good point. I said, I would fucking hate that. So it made me define my terms. You know, I said, so I called back the three companies that were interested in buying me. And I said, okay, well, number one, like, I'm gone. The minute the wire transfer is done, like, I'm not a consultant. I'm not working for you. I'm out. Number two, I need a very narrow non-compete, because these are my clients. These are my personal clients. And I get to keep my database of people, because these aren't just, you know, faceless customers. These are my friends. So first, you got to know if you're really, truly done or not. Second, you have to know under what conditions will you actually be happy with letting go of this thing that you've created. And then, yeah, about the money, about giving it away. If I was just talking about $1 million, I might not have given it away. I could say like, okay, $1 million could come in handy in my life. I could whether buy a house and use that for living money or whatever. But $22 million, once we had this agreed upon amount, first you got to understand, like, the company was already earning a few million dollars a year net profit, and I was the only owner. So I had millions of dollars. I had already paid off all my debts, and there was nothing I wanted to buy. I didn't want to, you know, buy a Ferrari or something stupid like that. So this idea of receiving an additional $22 million was like, wow, I had time to think about that. Like, 'cause there's 8 months in between, like, the agreed upon price and the actual deal being done. There was like this 8 months of time to think about this new situation for myself. And I mentioned to my tax lawyer, he was my lawyer, but he had a great tax background. I said, I'm just going to give it all to charity anyway. This is what's so funny about negotiating these amounts. It's like I'm saying, no, not 21 million, 22 million. And I said, it's just ridiculous because I'm just going to give it all away anyway. Like, I'm never going to use that money. And he said, are you sure about that? I said, yeah, I am never going to use $22 million. Like, what kind of idiot, playboy, fool would I have to be to spend $22 million in my lifetime, right? Like, no, I'm not one of those people. I don't want to be one of those people. I'm just going to give it away anyway. Like, I'll probably use a million or two in my lifetime, but not 22. So he said, okay, if you're really serious about this, there is something you can do that's really smart. And I used to think that I would never tell this story because it's so weird talking about money and I don't want to make it sound like I'm such a nice altruistic guy. It was more just like deciding what would make me the happiest. But I think this is worth telling in case any of your listeners might sell their company someday, that there is a smart way to set this up. And it goes like this, that if I would have just sold the company for $22 million and taken the money myself, then the buyer would have paid me $22 million. And then I would have paid income tax on that, like $7 million or so. And what would be left is $15 million. And that's what I'd have left to give to charity later, right? Mm-hmm. So what he recommended is, if you give away the company in advance, you create a charitable trust, and you actually transfer the ownership of the company into the charitable trust now. He said, ideally, you would have done it years ago if you really knew this in advance. So the sooner you do this, the better. You transfer the company into a charitable trust. And then when the purchasing company buys it, now that's a charitable transaction and it is tax-free. So now that $22 million never touches your hands. It never does go to you. It goes straight to the charity, bypasses all income tax because it is all going to charity. In fact, you've already given away your company to charity in advance of the sale. And yeah, so that meant $7 million more going to charity than if I had taken the money myself, paid income tax, and then given it to charity. So that's all. I felt very wholehearted about it also because I decided to give all that money to music education, which to me felt like closing the loop of the, what do you call that? The eco cycle, the circle of life, you know, mm-hmm. Like all of this money came from musicians and music fans. And so now it's going to go back in another generation or two to the next generation of musicians to help develop them. So totally felt like wholehearted, no regrets. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool, man. And so I wanted to touch real quick on the done, like final brushstroke statement that you'd made. How do you know it's done versus just burnout?
it could be the same thing. There might not be any difference. I guess you know about burnout if you take a good vacation and you're still not feeling it. So actually, I'm really glad you asked this. When I was considering selling and I was feeling these feelings of feeling done, I called this guy that was a bit of a coach for me. And I asked him, I said, Jared, I'm thinking of selling my company. Can you push back on this? Like, challenge me on this. Because my friends will just agree. They'll say, wow, man, that's great. I said, no, push back, challenge me. And he said, okay, why do you want to sell? I said, I don't want this responsibility anymore. I just want to be free of it. He said, okay, well, you can remain owner and be free of all responsibility. You could just disappear and go move to Hawaii and not give your employees your phone number and just collect the money. I said, okay, good point. I said, but I think I'd still feel some kind of moral obligation if I was the owner, that it would still ultimately be on the hook to me to handle this. And he said, well, that's not true. You don't have to do that. I said, yeah, you're right. I don't have to, but I think knowing my character, I think I would. And he pushed back and asked me lots of questions. And with each thing he said, it just became more and more apparent. Like, no, I really, really am done with this. I guess it's like selling a company is a bit like getting a divorce and graduating at the same time. It's like, it's bittersweet. It's like you're leaving this thing that you created. In that sense, it feels like a divorce. It's kind of sad, but then it's a little bit like graduating college or something. And this thing that everybody praises you for, you get this big reward. So Yeah, it's bittersweet, but I felt really wholehearted. So you'll just know because you'll feel wholehearted. Whereas if you're burned out, you'll still feel like you need a break, but you still might have some future vision for it.
Sure. More of an attachment versus a detachment.
Yes, thank you. Good way of putting it.
Okay. That's super helpful. And then the other blog post I wanted to touch on just real quick, because we're running up against the time limit here, but you don't have to be a local. Now, I think you're like pretty public about being introverted, right? Is that part of this idea of not having to be a local? Do you think it's true for either like personality types? What's your take there?
Yeah, probably. I know a lot of musicians, obviously, and a surprising amount of performers, like even lead singers up there on stage putting on the biggest show, are actually quite introverted people. That it's something that you can get on stage and turn on for great groups of people. But a lot of them don't choose to spend their time around a lot of people. They tend to be like quiet, inward focused, and then you're creating something for the world to appreciate, enjoy. You put on a show or you record an album or whatever it may be. So I feel more kinship with that kind of mentality, where there's other people that that making music is a big social thing. They get together with their friends and they make music and they like to be a part of a community and have a huge circle of friends. And I've just never really been that type. I always like one-on-one conversations. This would happen. There was an Indian friend of mine in Singapore that every single time we'd make an appointment to meet up, like me and Jay would say, hey, let's go out for lunch. He'd say, okay. Every single time at the last minute, he'd call me and say, oh, I'm bringing a couple friends along with. I'd be like, ah, fuck. I just wanted to talk with Jay. But to him, it's like, he's such an extrovert. The more, the better. Hey, a few more friends. It's even better now. But to me, it's like, no, I like one-on-one. This is my kind of style. So this idea of like a local community and being surrounded by lots of people, that didn't appeal to me. But also, I think it's only partially the introvert thing. Partially, it's more of just a worldview. Like, I don't see myself as a Chicago guy, right? Like, I grew up near Chicago. I don't see myself as Chicago dude. And I lived in Boston for a few years. I'm not from Boston now. I'm not part of the Boston scene. I lived in New York City for 10 years. Then I moved to Portland. So I think a lot of it is also the side effect of moving around. Like, I'm not from anywhere. I'm not a part of this scene in exclusion of others, right? Like yes, I am from Chicago. I'm also from Boston. I'm from New York. I'm from Portland, Oregon. Now I'm from Singapore. Now I'm from New Zealand too. Soon I'll be from Belgium. I just became a legal resident of Belgium. And so I like the idea of feeling kinship with all of these places, but not at the exclusion of any other. So I think the whole idea of feeling not local came from what people say, like, so what are you doing to benefit your local community? And feel, well, that's kind of prejudiced in a way. That's playing favorites. That's saying that these people that are physically proximate to me are somehow more important than people on the other side of the world. I disagree. I think that everybody all over the world is equally important to me. And so I'm going to focus my attention equally on all of them.
It seems like the world is your local.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I'm shooting for. But I mean, you know, I talk about nature versus nurture, that yes, I moved around a lot as a kid. So you could say that was it. But what's funny is like my sister is almost my same age and she's the exact opposite. Like she feels very, like she's in Portland, Oregon and feels very much like, no, I'm from Portland. This is where I'm going. This is where I'm from. This is where I'm going to die. This is the house I'm going to live in for the rest of my life. She loves stability. That's her motto. Like she's never been to Asia. She's never been like to most of the world and she has no interest. She never wants to go there. Doesn't care about it at all, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I have some friends that are the same way. They're like, I just like my stuff. I like being where I'm at. I'm not moving around. Yeah. Do you have advice for someone that is in that state, but they want to get out of it? You know, like they don't move around. They are very much attached to stuff. But they're like, you know, I want to change that about myself. I want to change that mindset about myself. What would be your advice to that person?
Nothing brilliant. Just book a flight. Go. It's that's what did it for me, honestly. So not that many years ago, I was living in Santa Monica, California, and I loved it. I love Santa Monica so much. And I felt like this is the end of the rainbow. I never need to be anywhere else. And then I broke up with my girlfriend and just suddenly had this epiphany that it's like, it's a big world out there. And whereas just like 2 weeks ago, I was feeling like I never need to be anywhere else but Santa Monica. Suddenly I felt like that's not what I want out of my life. Like, that's not me. I don't want to reduce my self-image down to like, I'm from here and that's it. I want to expand my self-image. I also want to be from Brazil and from Germany and from China. Like, I want to be from and feel a part of all these places. And so in that moment, like really, and it just happened just like this, I booked a flight that night. I was thinking about it and I spent a few hours thinking about it. Maybe I might've slept on it. It might've been the next day, but almost right away, I felt like, okay, if this is true, then I should book a flight and live somewhere else and just try it for like 6 months. And so I went, I was living in Portland, Oregon at the time, or I was in Portland at the time. I was officially living in Santa Monica, but I was up in Portland where my company was. And I remember that night being in the apartment and saying, let's check out flights from Portland to London. That would be like an easy place to start, is England for an American, right? If I'm going to live in another country. And then I went to go book the flight, and they make you at the time choose your round trip flight. Like, as a non-citizen or non-resident, you can't book a one-way flight. They need to see your return flight. Yep. And so it said, return date. I was like, oh, return date, 6 months. And so I picked a time 6 months away. I was like, and I clicked book it. And it was a surprisingly low price. I was like, wow, that's a really good price. So I said, book it. I typed in my credit card. And I was like, oh my God, I did it. And it was still a few months away. Like, I think in December, I booked a flight that was going to leave in May, like May through November. But I was like, I did it. I just booked my flight. I'm going to go live in London for 6 months. Like, I've decided that. And it was only, you know, $500 to book the flight. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I've now committed to that. And so then, you know, I had 5 months to arrange my affairs and settle things and do it. So yeah, I guess my advice is to book the flight.
Yeah. Set the ball in motion. The 10-month experience that we're on right now just was started with a rental posting. You know, it was
nice.
Like, we'll see if we can rent our house. And then it rented like in 3 days. And then my wife was like, shit. And like, you know, like we're actually going to do this thing, you know?
We did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to switch gears quickly here to slowness segment of the show, I wanted to talk to you about, you know, we had talked briefly about, you know, some intentional awareness or being specifically present with your family. Do you want to talk about this unique parenting schedule that you have? I think
sure.
It'd be really insightful for folks, whether you're a parent or not, on being like intentional about being 100% present.
Okay. So yeah. So a few years ago I had a kid, and he and I would wake up at like 5 or 6 a.m. every morning. And whereas his mom liked to sleep in until 9 a.m. So every morning from like 5 to 9, it would just be me and him. Hmm. And just a few times I would find that, and he was like 1 year old, 2 years old, he'd just be sitting there playing with blocks or whatever. And sometimes I'd kind of like turn on my phone and kind of surf the web a little bit. And then I would just always feel this icky feeling of like, what am I doing? Surfing? What the hell is coming through this screen that's more important than him? Like, nothing. And so I said, no. I'm not going to be one of those people. Like, this is it. He's only going to be two once. And like, whatever's out there can wait. And I just decided in that moment, like, no, never again, no more. So now anytime I'm with him, it's just all devices off. Ideally, don't even bring them with me. You know, there's no need to bring the phone, except maybe if I just feel like using the camera or something. But no, I turn it into airplane mode. It's just off. And it's like I've noticed recently that it feels like meditation. Like, I don't meditate. I mean, I have a few times in the past. I know what it is, but I don't do it as a regular practice, except with him, I kind of do. Like, when I'm with him, it's just all time stops. No clocks, no appointments, nothing else I need to do. I just made it a point of arranging my life in such a way that when I'm with him, everything stops. And therefore, we let his clock lead. Because kids don't know, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock. I found that most of my friends that would be like, oh, parenting is so hard. It's when they were trying to force their kids into this adult schedule of like, come on, it's 8:55. You have to finish your breakfast and we have to leave now. Like, a kid doesn't know what 8:55 is. I mean, yeah, okay, a 14-year-old does. But I'm talking like, I can only speak from my experience with a tiny little toddler. Yeah, I just decided to let go of this whole idea of clocks and appointments and all that. And my time with him is just like meditation, and he leads. I'm just there to kind of follow and keep him out of trouble. But if he wants to throw rocks into the water for 3 hours, then that's what we do. We just sit there and I don't do anything else. I just sit there and appreciate like throwing rocks in the water for 3 hours. Or if he suddenly wants to change gears, or if I say, hey, let's go here, and he doesn't want to, I go, okay. Just he leads, and it's really nice. It feels like meditation. So right now, yeah, my schedule is Thursday midday through Sunday midday. I'm full-time duty. So I just make a point of finishing everything I'm doing by Thursday midday, and I shut down everything, and I don't turn it back on until Sunday. And I just love that schedule. Just everything stops, and I'm just fully present.
And I think the side benefit, if you want to call it that, is that you're also fully present when you're working, right? Quote unquote. Working.
Yeah. Because then
you're fully focused on that.
Yep. Because then obviously, because of the way that we set this up is like, so his mom is like, she's on full time from Sunday afternoon till Thursday midday. So now I'm like guilt free, just throwing myself into work from 5 a.m. till midnight or whatever. Yeah.
So interesting. And so in our house, we have a kind of a phrase, whether we're traveling or at home, it's like, it's up to us whether we all have a good time. Like it's not up to the children at all.
Yeah.
And so the times that we've had the most fun, it's like the road trip from Iowa out to Arizona where we are now. We just stopped wherever. Kids want to stop.
Nice.
Stop.
Yep. Love that.
They see something cool, we just pull over. And that kind of freedom, I think to them was like totally inspiring. And they also thought like, wow, this is just crazy. Like we don't normally do things this way. Normally we've got a place we got to be at a certain time. And I think for them it was very freeing. And so it opened my eyes up to like wanting to be able to do that more. And so I love the idea that you're doing this weekly.
Oh man, you could, you could get onto a bigger, deeper subject of expectations being the root of all unhappiness. That if you truly expect nothing, then you're never disappointed. I think there was actually a little Buddhist book I read like 20 years ago called Expect Nothing. And it was about that. I think the introduction said, you know, I used to get upset so much and I realized that the root of all these root of all this upset was that I was expecting my brother to say thank you when I would do something for him. I was expecting my mom to show up when she said she would, you know, things like this. And I'd get upset for people, upset at people for being late. I'd get upset when people weren't doing what I thought they should. And I just realized that if I could just stop expecting anything and just let everything be a surprise, I wouldn't be upset. And she said, and it's true. So I like that, what you said about just the trip to Arizona. And just if you can let go of all these expectations, like, no, we have to get to this city by this hour. If you just let go of all that and just go with the flow, no upset. I love it. It's like friction-free parenting. It's to me, it's just been easy as hell. I mean, granted, I'm in a lovely situation where I'm semi-retired. That's actually my main advice for friends that don't have kids that are asking me about it. I said, wait until you're at a time in your life where you can really take a nice sabbatical and give your kid full-time attention. Because, yeah, if I would have tried to have a kid 10 years ago while I was like building CD Baby, I would have been a horrible parent. I would have been way conflicted. But, yeah, luckily I'm at a time in my life when I can do this.
Yeah, yeah. And then to speak to that expectation, there's a phrase, I think it's Hal Elrod's phrase, gap focus, like focusing on the gap between where you are and where you want it to be or where you want to be. And I think that is definitely where that frustration comes from. It's where you're not there where you thought you'd be or where you want to be. And then that's where the conflict comes in.
Yeah.
And to also, I mean, since we're in slowness, you know, you talked about slow thinking. Do you want to speak to that? And you also said you wanted to mention something about notes in advance.
Yeah. So you audience listening, watching, I asked Peter to send me the questions in advance, not out of some like media control freak thing, but because I've just recently started admitting that I'm not a fast thinker. Like, I'm a slow thinker. When somebody asks me a question off the top of my head, like say if somebody's on the phone or in person, they say something like, what's the most surprising thing you've learned in the past year? I'm stumped. I'm like, I don't know. I'll spend a whole awkward minute of silence just sitting there. I don't know. But if you were to ask me that question in writing, then I'll spend 10 minutes with it and I'll think about it. And then I'll get to a deeper answer. Or sometimes you'll ask me a question and I have a shallow, like top of my mind, tip of my tongue answer that's not really the most interesting answer. But if I have another 5 minutes, I can think of something that's a lot more interesting. So that's why I want to do an interview like this. I like to get the questions in advance, because if this would have all just been top of head, I wouldn't have had time to think about some of these deeper issues. So So I think it's admitting that I'm a slow thinker has been very liberating.
Admitting and then also being okay with it. Like, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah. It actually feels like wisdom a bit in a world that's often very rushed and shallow. It's kind of saying that, like, no, the rushed thing, the quick thing is often a shallow thing. I prefer to go deeper than that.
Okay. I like that, man. Well, hey, just a rapid fire question for you. Cause I think we're running out of time here, but what would you say you're passionate about? Like, what gets you out of bed in the morning? Besides the obvious, like kicking the nuts from the kid or something like that.
No, it changes all the time. To me, it's whatever I'm currently focused on makes me jump out of bed early in the morning. I tend to just go for one thing at a time. So there'll be a phase like through December through April, I was completely fascinated with this new approach to programming I was taking, where I was putting more of the logic into the database itself instead of the Ruby code surrounding it. And that idea was like so revolutionary and exciting to me that I would jump out of bed at like 4:30 in the morning in the dark. I'd just jump straight back into my terminal and just start programming right away. And I'd be programming all day long until midnight when I'd make myself go to sleep. And 4:30, I'd jump out of bed again and do it again. And so there'll be times for like 5 months at a time where I'll be really into one thing like that. And then I finished in April. I was like, yeah, okay, I'm done. And then I started focusing on this project we talked about earlier about the compressing everything I've learned from books into advice. And I did nothing but that for 5 months. So I tend to just go for one thing at a time, which is currently interesting me. Yeah.
Got it. Well, Derek, it's been a pleasure, man. I mean, thanks so much for taking the time. Super enjoyed it. If somebody wants to keep in tabs on what you're working on, what's the best way?
Well, first, obviously, my website, go to sivers.org. But the thing that I would like to encourage people to do, as you could tell, like the reason I do interviews like this is I'm not pitching anything. I don't care if you buy my book or not. I only make a dollar, I think. Who cares? But I like the people that I meet when I do these things. You know, the slow hustle listeners are my kind of people. So if you made it all the way to the end of this, my email address is Derek, D-E-R-E-K, @sivers.org, and send me an email and introduce yourself, and I answer every single email I get. So if you have any questions, send me a question, and if you just want to introduce yourself, just say hi and we'll keep in touch.
Awesome, man. Derek, it's been awesome. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Take care. All right, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did and came away with some action items. For the show notes, simply go to slowhustle.com to check out the show notes for this episode plus many others. We are in the early days of this experiment, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you, and I really mean that. So please, please, please send in your comments and suggestions via the contact form on the site. Or you can tweet at me at slowhustle or at Peter Awad, that's PeterAwad. I'd love to hear about what you liked, didn't like, or want to hear more of. Also, if you have a recommendation of someone you'd like for me to have on the show, send me their name and why you want to hear from them. Lastly, if you enjoyed the show, the absolute best way you can support it are by subscribing, reviewing, and giving us an honest rating. Of course, 5 stars is preferred. Just saying. That'll go a really long way. Oh, and sharing this with your friends is cool too. Thanks for listening.